I guess that's on now. Well, thank you for the invitation, and I wanted to thank ITP for this wonderful semester, which is just great. I'm going to talk about epidemics. Now, last week, Pierre Coulet gave a nice colloquium in which I very much admired his lecture demonstrations. And I was thinking of doing that, and then I thought about the subject, and I thought, maybe I shouldn't. It seems to me that, you know, epidemics sort of don't need introduction. I mean, they are the scourge of mankind. We know that this is one of the great disasters. The great disasters that repeat itself for people is that you have these horrible epidemics, like the horrible flu of 1918-1919, which killed 20 or 30 million people. It was a complete pandemic. We have had reminders lately with AIDS and West Nile and SARS and so forth that we're certainly not over that problem. I'm going to be talking about various epidemics and give you a little introduction to the subject and to sort of give you an idea of the kinds of things that the epidemiologists do and what we can try to do. And some of the diseases are going to be kind of an obsolete subject, like smallpox, but it's not so clear that smallpox is obsolete, an obsolete thing to talk about. Many of you may have read in the newspapers that the last smallpox outbreak in New York City was in 1947. So it's sort of a disturbing thing. I got into this field because there's a distinguished epidemiologist, mathematician at Michigan and I listened to lots of the stuff that he did, and I realized that perhaps, and I hope so, some of the things that a statistical physicist knows could bring some light onto the subject. So this is by way of saying what a statistical physicist gets at when he looks at epidemiology. Here are some papers that I've written on the subject. There was a comment in our patterns workshop that if you're working in mathematical biology and you publish in a physics journal, it's an admission of defeat. So there are two defeats in one, and one success, I guess. I'm going to talk about most of this stuff. Now, there is a way in which this subject is very different from the kind of mathematical biology that we've been hearing about this semester. It is common for physicists to say that biologists have a different view of science, that the quantitative approach is much less common in biology, and the kind of thing that we bring to the subject, the kind of rigor and mathematical modeling, is foreign to their point of view. This is not in the least true in mathematical epidemiology, because this is a mathematical subject from the outset. I'll talk about that in a moment. Here is the outline, and since you're going to hear it, I won't say very much more about the outline except to emphasize that I'm going to be talking about probabilistic spatial models for the spread of infections, and we'll see how we do this, and I'm going to be talking about two ways in which we think it's important in the case where there's great variability in infection rates and when contact networks, the network of the people you infect, is very inhomogeneous. So here is the beginning of the subject of mathematical epidemiology. Here's a guy you've heard of. Daniel Bernoulli, of course, this is one of the Bernoulli family, one of the most distinguished of the Bernoulli family. The history of this of his paper in 1760 is fascinating. It began, as many things do, with a technological advance, which came from an unexpected place. Smallpox was a terrible scourge at that time. You could expect a third of the children to die of smallpox. I mean, this is just, you know, nothing to do about it. The technological advance came from the Ottoman Empire, of all places. The British ambassador to Constantinople in the beginning of the 18th century was Lord Montagu. Lady Montagu brought back from Constantinople a notion which was common in Turkey of inoculating people with live smallpox virus. Now that sounds like suicide, and it is in some sense. You take some stuff from someone who has smallpox, they were very easy to find, and you scratch it into a wound, and you get deathly ill. But 98% of the people survived, and then they, you know, They didn't die of smallpox, whereas you could expect, you know, a quarter of the people to die of smallpox otherwise. So it was worth it. And if you read biographies from the time, you'll see that people in fact went through this. For example, Abigail Adams, the wife of John Adams, had this procedure, became deathly ill, but she thought it was worth it. What Bernoulli was interested in, oddly enough, was suppose we vaccinate everybody with this, or inoculate. This is not the Lister vaccination, which came later, which of course is cowpox and it doesn't kill you. What would be the effect on mortality? In particular, how should you change mortality tables used in life insurance? It was an amazing beginning for a subject. In particular, he had very sophisticated differential equations to study this thing. It gave rise to a huge controversy with D'Alembert, and was kind of an interesting thing, but like many precursors, was not particularly followed up. The modern subject began, I just want to say something about Bernoulli. Bernoulli had certain ideas already in this paper. One of them is herd immunity, which I'll talk about later. Herd immunity refers to the fact that you don't have to vaccinate everybody in order to make the disease not propagate. And he defined the force of infection, which we'll see in a minute, and so forth. And there's some numbers in here which I found absolutely fascinating. I tried to get Bernoulli's original paper. I couldn't get it. I have seen it, but I couldn't get a copy. This is Klaus Dietz has talked about this subject, found out about this from him. Look at the life expectancy in Paris. Wow. Okay. Okay. So all right. So things have changed since then, but not so much.
Children who died.
Yeah, I think that's a life expectancy at birth, not at one. Because the main victims at that time of smallpox were children. They were exposed and they died, and then not much you could do about it. The model that I'm going to use, which is appropriate for epidemics of the type that I'm going to talk about throughout this talk, is called the SIR model, and it was invented in 1927 by these guys. And it is appropriate to an epidemic like influenza, like SARS, like other epidemics, where you have a rapid epidemic, you get sick, you get well, or you die. It doesn't matter for this model. And that's all. You don't get sick again. So you have an epidemic which passes through a population. Okay? This is the SIR model, that you have three classes of individuals: susceptible, infected, and recovered, or removed. And it doesn't matter for this model. They just don't contribute to infection further. And furthermore, I'm going to be talking about cases where the epidemic is rapid compared to the vital dynamics. So we don't have to consider births and deaths. We're going to consider a population of fixed size. And there are two things that we should define, which you can measure. One is the recovery rate, which I'll call 1 over tau, which is just, it's obvious what that is. And the other is what epidemiologists call the force of infection, which is the contact rate between individuals, the number of number of contacts which put people at risk, multiplied by the probability to infect per contact. Okay, that's a well-defined object, units 1 over time. And here is the model, which Kermack and McKendrick invented, and it's very like models that we've been hearing about in throughout the program, and this is a classic example. The number of susceptibles decreases according to the context between susceptible and infected. You have to start with at least one infected. The force of infection is normalized by N. That is, this is the force of infection per contact. You assume that you contact everyone in a huge population. This is a mean field theory. Then that adds to this compartment. This compartment gets healed. And then the recovered are added. So these are very simple, albeit nonlinear differential equations, a set of three nonlinear differential equations. And here is a typical numerical solution to these equations. Here are the susceptibles, which go down, and not everybody gets sick for this set of parameters. Here are the infected, goes up and goes down, and that's the end of the story. Okay, there's nothing to it, really, though it's interesting. And here's the data that Kermack and McKendrick compared the model to. There was plague in Bombay in 1905, and a lot of people died. In fact, in the caption of this figure, which I do not reproduce, it said that you can consider that the number infected and the number who died were the same for the purpose within the error, you know, that is to say, almost everybody who got plague died. And you see this is very rapid, and in this fits the data pretty well. Okay? So that's in fact...
The data, the black dot.
Yes?
That's probably plotting the function.
Yeah, he didn't have a computer, so he had to, you know, French curves and things. This was 1927, Dan. Okay? So, let me say some things about the SIR deterministic mean field equations, which I just described, because they're going to be of interest in the remainder of the talk. One is just the top, it's just a technical, I mean, it's a silly technical point that you can make. You can rescale into proportions of the population. And the reason I want to do that is you notice that if you consider the initial condition where there's a certain number of susceptibles on the order of unity when you start and a few infected, then this equation initially has a reproduction rate, lambda minus 1 over tau. And in order to have an epidemic, that is to say for you have an increase in the number of infected, you have to have that number greater than 1. And that means that this quantity, which is everybody's favorite quantity in epidemiology, has to be greater than 1. R0 is called the basic reproduction number. It's defined as the following. If I get sick and I infect Pierre and Tony, then the basic reproduction number is 2. It's a mean number of new infected per infected you start with. It's the growth rate. And the basic reproduction number has been measured for lots of things. Measles is very infected. And those of us who are old enough to remember measles among children, that's amazing. It's an amazing disease. You know, you can't stop it. Smallpox is not nearly as bad, though of course the consequences are far worse. And the significance of that, you can say in the following, explain in the following way. Suppose you need to vaccinate. Suppose you vaccinate people in the population. How many do you have to vaccinate in order to get R0 less than 1? That is to say, so the epidemic will not grow. Well, it turns out, I mean, it's a very easy thing to figure out. That's 1 minus 1 over R0.
Okay.
I think it's very high. I think it's of this order. Influenza. I think for influenza, it's extremely high. That's why, by the way, when I'm working with these collaborators that I mentioned on the first slide, one of them is Jim Copeland, who's in public health, said, actually, smallpox, people are talking about smallpox for bioterrorism. He says, it's really not a problem. R naught is 4. If you want to suppress smallpox, you do ring vaccination. You find the guys who are sick, and you surround them, and you vaccinate everybody. You can save people even in the same household. The real terror is influenza. You just can't do anything about influenza because it spreads so fast. And, of course, there was a deadly influenza in 1919. Everybody knows what the genetic mutation was. It's perfectly possible that it happened again, and nobody knows what to do about it.
Wouldn't this R be dependent on population density?
I mean, that goes in the contact rate. That goes in lambda, which goes in R. Yes?
Yes, but then you specify for each disease.
That's for a typical, yes, indeed. That's for a typical, you know, yes, indeed. You should say that what R0 is in a central city and what obviously R0 is rather small if you have little country towns and people never see each other. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. What I'm emphasizing here is the sort of infectiousness, you know, the other factor here. Okay. And furthermore, there are a certain number which, this is not so hard formula to derive, there are a certain number at the end of any epidemic who don't get infected, and it's it's given, according to the SAR model, by this little implicit equation, which isn't so hard to solve. So, numerically. Let me give an example of current interest. This is SARS. Now, SARS, people have a tendency now that SARS didn't do much damage to dismiss SARS. And SARS was, in fact, pretty scary. And the reason is, this is, first thing I should say, how do you measure R0? You measure R0 by the dynamics of the infection. You look at this curve and see how it's growing. The initial infection rate depends on R0. And that's how you measure it. So you can estimate it. Yes? If you, it's not obvious from this curve. This is SARS in Hong Kong. This thing would have gone up to 5 million in Hong Kong, as we'll see in a minute. Okay, the death rate from SARS was about 10%. That would have been 500,000 deaths in Hong Kong alone if the disease had been not controlled by public health measures. In fact, if you look at these figures carefully, you see that the public health measures were really remarkably successful. And a fantastic success in Hong Kong and Toronto and in Vietnam. The places that learned to take care of it were, in fact, doing remarkable work. We'll see how it works this winter. So what is R0? Well, this is where I get that estimate of 500,000 dead. Here is an estimate from the Vital Dynamics. These are various estimates of various groups of R0 at the beginning when they didn't know what it was. So it's untreated. And in this week, they figured it out, and look, they already brought it down below one. They already won the game here, and then they won it. They brought it down again. Okay, so this is an example of how this classical epidemiology actually works remarkably well. Now, what's left out? I mean, I talked about SARS in Hong Kong, or smallpox in Breslau, which was what Bernoulli was interested in, or London or Paris or something like that, in some well-mixed environment where you have everybody see everybody else. But of course, on a large enough scale, or for other kinds of diseases, for example, diseases of plants, you cannot neglect spatial variables, and I'm going to talk a little about spatial variables. This is another example of a great scourge of mankind, the same infection that I've already mentioned, namely plague, which came into Europe in the 14th century, and maps like this abound of the spread of the plague. And you see that it was introduced in Marseille and came through Sicily and then, wow, zoom within in 3 years. And thereafter recurred in Europe for many centuries until almost the modern era. So now how do you deal with that? Well, there is one way to deal with that, which is favorite of mathematical biologists, which is to write a reaction diffusion equation. Just take the SIR epidemic equations and add diffusion terms. And that's okay if you have slow variations and local mixing. I'm going to introduce another way to deal with that in a moment. Okay, so that's a kind of background, the kind of primer of epidemiology. And let's see what a statistical physicist might bring to this. Well, for one thing, this question of perfect mixing is, I think, troublesome. And I think it's even troublesome in allegedly well-mixed environments, as we'll see. Also, there's a question of variability. In fact, the last few days we've been hearing about the immune system from a number of our visitors. And of course, we know that, like everything in biology, acquiring an infection is an extremely variable thing. I may be not very susceptible. He may be very susceptible. And he may try to give me the disease and won't work. But the question is, that how do you put that into a model like the SRM model? And the traditional way is to average over the susceptibilities. And you have all kinds of peculiar questions about what average you should take And I'll mention it, at least as we go along, that that the kind of average that we come up with is not the one that you might expect. There's another way to deal with the problem, and that's to make more compartments. In other words, you might say children are more likely to be infected than adults, so you have a compartment for children. In fact, you have three compartments for children: sick children, susceptible children, infected children, and so forth. And sometimes they'll come up, you know, have a model with 30 or 40 compartments, which people work out. So that's one way that in which this thing is left up. Also, there's a question of fluctuations. Now, you might say, now wait a minute, you know, 6 million people in Hong Kong, how can fluctuations be important? But fluctuations are important, certainly when you have spatial variation. There's certainly patchiness in a neighborhood. You can observe it, right? There's a classic case, which is a so-called size effect in measles. Measles is a disease of children, at least in modern times. The children give it to each other at school. Children have very unsanitary habits, and that's how measles is transmitted. And so there is a annual variation in measles. It goes up in the fall and up and down, up and down. And that's observed everywhere, except if the town is too small. If a town is too small and isolated, then when it goes up in the fall, during the summer, it'll just go extinct and wait. Okay, and the best example, in fact, I learned this just yesterday from one of our speakers in the immune workshop. The Faroe Islands are tiny communities that belong to Denmark. In Copenhagen, measles every year until vaccination. Okay, in the Faroe Islands, it was absent from 1781 to 1846 when a ship arrived. When a ship arrived from the mainland and started it up again. In the more modern era, measles was, there were bursts of measles because there were more frequent contacts, of course.
They did a lot of trading in the Faroes. I can't believe they were as isolated as this suggests. They're traders.
Yes, but children with measles evidently weren't on the ships. Okay, I heard this at a talk yesterday, and whoever said it is here, so you can ask them for a reference. All right. So what do we do? Well, we decided to look at this in sort of a naive way, and what it'll turn out, a naive way, which is, you know, my early training led me to, which turns out to be interesting, and it seizes a number of effects which are not ordinarily put into classical epidemiology. And this is what I think is the interest of this work. Okay, so what I do is make a lattice model, which is something statistical physicists do if not prevented. And I put an agent on each point of the lattice, and that agent could be, you can think of it as a person or a plant or whatever. And they don't move, for simplicity. And you have this lattice, you have an agent, and you have a contact between them, which I'll call a bond. Okay? And if this agent is susceptible and this guy is infected, then the disease can go from one to the other. And the probability per time step of the simulation to go from one to the other is lambda. And I'm going to let the lambdas depend on the bond. This is a lambda for the ice bond. That's the way I put in variability. I may or may not have close contact with this guy. We're in the next office, I probably do, but with, you know, someone whose office is more distant, I don't. And you know, I may see people rarely or not, and also I can encode in that same bond strength. I can encode the my susceptibility, his infectivity, and the contact rate. Because all three things are encoded in this lambda. Yes. It would be interesting to do to make a change. But in the course of a rapid epidemic like I'm thinking about, it is not usually the case. By the way, let me just say what I understand from my public health friends. Epidemics with large variabilities, which is going to be the part of the interesting situation, are usually those which come back. And you have an epidemic sweep through a population, it does various things to people, and they react in various ways. If it comes back the next year, then you have a very wide distribution of lambdas, typically. And so this is the kind of thing that we're going to...
Public health people work on the lambda.
You bet. Yeah. There are some surprises we see. Okay. Anyway, here is a picture of the lattice, and the red are infected, and the black are susceptible, and the green recovered. And what we're going to do is take quenched disorder with no correlations. We're going to just take some. We're going to draw the lambdas from some probability function f, and that's the model. And here is, I learned it since I came to KITP that you can't give a talk without a movie. So, there we go. Okay, this is the epidemic, and it repeats. And the red ones you see are the infected ones, and the blue ones are the guys who are recovered. Now, I want you to notice something. I'll try to stop it sort of at the end here. There are some areas here which are not infected. These, by the way, these guys are all the same. For this simulation, I chose a particular value of lambda and tau, which I'll tell you about how I chose it in a minute. But there is no variability in the bonds. Zero. It's a stochastic model, but everything is uniform. And look at these islands. Okay? These are islands where nobody has been infected, and they will never be infected because they're surrounded by recovered. An epidemiologist has called this a firewall. We'll see that we in statistical physics have a different name for this in a minute. Look at these big areas where you don't get infected. There's this intrinsic patchiness in this model. Okay? Now, some of you came to Jean Carlson's talk a few weeks ago where she showed a picture of bark beetle infections in whatever the National Forest is, an area photograph where you can tell by the color of the foliage, if the trees, and it's very patchy and it looked rather like this. Okay, so we've actually thought of using such pictures to map out the patchiness. Okay, now if I hadn't given the title my talk that I did, I would have a poll of the audience: does anyone recognize this pattern? But of course, everyone recognizes this pattern. This is a percolation cluster. This is the giant cluster in percolation. And we'll see why in a minute. This model has nothing to do with percolation. Every bond is there. There are no missing bonds. Right? These guys, and in this case, they're all exactly the same. Nevertheless, you get percolation.
In your simulation, you use periodic bonding.
Yeah. That's rare in nature. Pardon?
It paints it even more.
No.
It spreads around.
If I had not done that, the holes would be even bigger.
That's right.
This is as if you had a focus here, a focus here, a focus here, a focus there.
Exactly.
Yes? So it's even worse.
So, Len, in your first slide on the SIR, you show that there's an S infinity, not all susceptibles become infected. Does that S infinity sort of correspond to the black area here?
No. Yeah. Yeah, and I'll say exactly what the relationship is in a minute. Okay. One infected in the middle of the lattice. Here's a still of a much larger lattice, and you see one of these huge holes. This is also periodic boundary condition, so the holes are, in fact, not as big as they ought to be. Okay. Now, let's ask if this patchiness really corresponds to anything that you might expect to happen in the world. Well, as I already mentioned, plant diseases, this is known in the literature, plant diseases do have this patchy spread, even in relatively homogeneous environments. Okay? Well, plants, particularly in a cornfield, putting them on a lattice is not a bad idea. Now, how about people? And this, in fact, kind of surprised us. There's this famous study, this is the Brownsville study, of intravenous drug users who share needles and pass AIDS in, and there, it's probably the most detailed study of contact networks ever carried out. Enormous effort.
Maybe not everyone knows what Brownsville is.
It's a place.
Right.
in Brooklyn.
But it's a famous place.
Famous place. Okay. The title actually, I don't know why he bothered to write a talk if he has a conclusion in a title. Write a paper, he has a whole conclusion in a title. But the point is that for reasons that which Friedman and his colleagues found surprising, there is patchiness in the infection, in the fact that HIV positive people are patchy in the contact network. There are people who, by all rights, have just as many disgusting habits as other people, but do not get HIV because they're surrounded by people who don't. Okay, in the network of contacts, and this is what led Friedman to coin the term firewall for these protections, which are basically protections by chance. Now, in a perfect mixing theory, that's what they were comparing to, of course. In a perfect mixing theory, you don't get this.
Who are the R people in this country? They haven't recovered
from. Pardon me?
Who are the R people in
this? I mean, you can't get, I mean, they're counted as anyone who is HIV positive. You can't get it twice. Oh, I see. You're saying that the recovery rate is very long. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. It's probably that they stay in the pool a certain finite time.
It's not recovered. If they're removed, they die.
No, to HIV, you die in 8 years. I mean, no, this is long before.
Okay, so the R group is the people who have died.
Who have died or have withdrawn from the pool. And probably, I mean, I don't know. You would have to look into it. It's likely that people who start showing AIDS symptoms are then thrown out of the crack house. I mean, I don't know. You would hope so. But anyway, okay, so now I'm going to make a simple observation which will rationalize what we've seen so far. If you have this bond from this guy to this guy, every time step you get a chance, lambda I, to complete the bond. So the chance of not completing the bond in tau time steps is 1 minus lambda to the tau. The chance of completing the bond ever is 1, et cetera. This is a simple elementary probability. And for a large time, you can write it this way. That means that there are some bonds present and some bonds absent at the end, a posteriori. Which means, and I hope you can see this because I just want to make a little sketch. You have a lattice. When you're all finished, the pattern looks like a certain number of bonds at random put into the lattice, and the probability of putting those bonds into the lattice is P. This P, this is P of tau and lambda. Okay? Which means we have the classic bond percolation problem. Let me just mention, for those of you who aren't familiar, probably most of us, everyone is, bond percolation corresponds to exactly what I've sketched over there. You have, for example, a rock, and you're trying to pass water through it, hence the term percolation. And some of the channels are open and some are closed. And the probability of being open is P. Yes, probability of being open is P. And you ask, as a function of P, how likely are you to get across the rock? And there are theorems in this field, we'll come to a little bit about that later, that if P is above a certain critical value called PC, the percolation threshold, you can get across the rock no matter how big. There will be a single, unique, infinite cluster, so-called, which just at threshold is a fractal, and that'll be interesting in a moment, which spans a lattice no matter how large. Okay? And the probability, excuse me, the mass of the infinite cluster, the percentage of the rock taken up by that infinite cluster starts at zero at PC. This is a function of P, and this is something I'll call P infinity. and goes up like this. Okay, that's a percentage taken up by the infinite, whoops, starts here. And take, that's a percentage of the rock which is occupied by the infinite cluster. Okay, that's a quick review of percolation theory. That's all I'll need, actually, from percolation theory. So, another fact, for a square lattice bond percolation, PC is exactly a half. So we have a criterion for this epidemic. The criterion is that you take tau and you take lambda, you compute this number, and if it's greater than a half, you can get an epidemic, and if it's less than a half, you can't get an epidemic. This is rather like R0. Yes? For this stochastic model, we have an exact analog of R0, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, yeah, it isn't quite the same thing.
So which way is it working?
When lambda tau is small, it's...
Which is the mean field theory would predict an epidemic, this, I mean, which is more susceptible? I guess this must be because...
No, this is harder. It's harder for an epidemic. You can stop, yeah.
But this reduces the lambda tau.
I thought it increased it because it wouldn't require, or could, you could do it by a fractal instead of a homogeneous, but it would be more likely in this model.
Well, it's a simple arithmetic question. Is 1 minus e to the minus lambda tau bigger or smaller than lambda tau?
1 over e, right?
That's
not
a factor of 2, because PC is a half, not 1. Whereas R naught critical is 1.
The large factor of 2. Yeah, this is PC is much bigger than half.
So I think that's right.
R equals 1. This is 1.8 over 2.8.
Okay. Okay. So I'm just saying again what we've just been discussing, that this serves as a threshold, but a threshold which is a considerably different interpretation than that of R0. R0 says that if you're above R0, the epidemic just starts. That's not what this says. That's not what this says. It says, let me come back to this in a moment. This says that if you are above the epidemic, above the threshold, you have a probability to start an epidemic, because this is a stochastic model. If you have an infected, nevertheless, I mean, this is sort of reasonable. The epidemic could die before it gets big enough to get started. Okay? So what I plotted here, I called it M, but I'll change notation in a minute, that this is the probability for that same model with uniform lambda. This is the probability of launching an epidemic for these values of tau for fixed lambda.
An epidemic is a percolation cluster?
Yes. Thank you. An epidemic, the way I define an epidemic in what follows, is an infection where you start in the middle and you reach the edge. Okay? That's what we did. We started at the middle, and if you reach the edge, or if you start one side, reach the other side, then, and that's size dependent, but we took pretty big lattices. Okay, so that's what these guys are. This is a square lattice, this is a triangular lattice. And you get a picture. Now, let me go back to the slide I skipped. Where am I? I'm in the wrong way. Okay, if you have variable lambdas, then if you think about it for 5 minutes, you realize that this is the right formula to replace P. So P of tau now depends on tau, and also depends on F. And if F is broad and skewed, you get really kind of interesting results, which I'll talk about in a moment. I explained how that could be. It's most interesting, and this is not unphysical or unbiological, that you can have a situation where there are many people who are not very infected, and some people infective, and some people who are very infective. Yes? And then you can get some interesting results. For herd immunity, the thing that replaces the number that you have to vaccinate is, you say, suppose if I vaccinate a fraction Q of the population, then you dilute this F by 1 minus Q, and you add this to lambda equals zero, and you put it back in this formula and you do a calculation again, and if p is less than a number of order unity, then you have, that's the criterion. Now, I wanted to say...
Isn't this a kind of a mean field theory?
No. All of these bonds are independent. So this reasoning, which I partially effaced here, works bond by bond. That's why I get to count the number. That's why I get to count this number just by adding up. Okay, so here's the formula because it's Quinch, exactly. So here is what happens when I put in some f's. Actually, these things that I said were for a uniform are actually for a narrow distribution. That's why it amounts to the same thing. This is for a broad distribution. And the broad distribution has the effect of broadening the curve, as you might guess. Right? This is kind of interesting. It's still percolation, but it doesn't have the property of percolation, which is that this rises very steeply. In fact, you can spread this thing out quite broadly. So let me not tell you the dirty secret of what I've been doing up till now, how I chose lambda and tau in order to get those interesting pictures. Of course, I chose them where p is near a half. Now, a little bit above a half. I chose 0.55 or something like that. And you might say, well, you know, that's the famous fine-tuning problem. Everybody knows statistical physicists are obsessed with critical phenomena, but how likely is that in nature? I mean, you know, come on. So, you know, you guys, well, you know, have to make a living is one excuse. But another excuse is right here. If you have a broad distribution, the region over which the pattern is interesting, let's say from between here and here, can be arbitrarily broad. This is a log scale. So you can have a very substantial range of parameters where you have patchy distributions. And that I claim that that's why you actually do see them in nature. Otherwise, you never would. Mm-hmm. So the threshold is not a little bitty point.
The lattice,
yeah, that's just that's because the threshold's different. Yeah, R equal 4 is 17. It's way over there. That's right. Nevertheless, we're talking about near threshold. Absolutely. Okay. So how do I understand these curves? Well, I've already sort of told you. Above PC, there's a unique giant cluster. The unique giant cluster occupies a fraction P infinity of the whole lattice, this curve. The starting site of the epidemic is a random site. So its probability to belong to the giant cluster is P infinity. And so P infinity is the probability to span. And I claim I can test that by a data collapse. That is to say, I can take all those curves before, which I plotted as a function of the physical parameters before, and plot them as a function of P. And here they go. Okay, so all the curves do, in fact, data collapse very well. And this is, now, the cognoscenti will object that this falls below 1.5. Of course, this is a finite size effect. It's all for a fixed size lattice. And if you would have bigger and bigger lattices, this would move over. And these are for various distributions, wide distributions, narrow distributions, and so forth. I didn't do triangular lattice, but I could have. This is square lattice. All right. So that's the model. Now, what can we do with a model like that? What kind of thing that can you say? Well, one of the things you can say is this is a program that my colleague Jim Copeman is dealing with. You know, sort of, how do you know what the contact network is? Well, one way that you can do it in principle is look at the genetic difference between the viruses in various people. Right? Viruses mutate. If I infect you, then one virus particle out of 10 to the oomph, you know, some huge number, comes from me to you. And that is likely to be an atypical one. So the genetic drift is going to be proportional to the number of transmissions. And so we can, in this model, we can track the number of transmissions. We get something interesting. Namely, if we look at the number of transmissions since the origin of the epidemic. Above threshold, of course, there's nothing special going on here. This is a power law rise. And that's because the paths on a percolation cluster are circuitous and have a fractal dimension. And this power law rise is probably related to it's pretty close to the suitable fractal dimension, the chemical dimension of a percolation cluster. Okay, I'm going to skip this very quickly. There's something called small world effects. And people talk about the fact, I'm talking about plant diseases, but of course plants don't ride airplanes, except or very rarely, but people do. And so suppose we put in airplane rides. Occasionally, you just go from one side of the lattice to the other. And so you take a lattice, and instead of having just short bonds, you have a few long bonds that are randomly distributed. Okay, I'm going to quickly go through this. You get a picture like that. Now, it still has firewalls, and it still has islands, though they're smaller. And you notice these clusters are not connected, or at least not apparently. It's because there's a long bond between here and here, say. Okay? And we're interested in the percolation threshold, and I know someone here is interested in this. There is a trick due to Newman and Watts, which we used, which allows you to calculate the percolation threshold in this case by saying that the clusters are like the nodes of a giant graph. They're randomly connected, so it's a random graph. And the work of Erdős and Renyi allows us to calculate exactly for a random graph, and we did that. So here is the calculation of the percolation threshold, and here is our simulation data, and it works pretty well. So that's kind of nice. And here are the corresponding B infinities for that case. Well, okay, now in the last 10, 15 minutes, I want to talk about a different subject. So far I've talked about variability. I've talked about variability in contact rates. But there's another kind of variability that has become quite popular recently, and it's variability in the contact network. Suppose the contact network isn't a square lattice. Of course, any sociologist would tell you, oh, square lattice, don't be ridiculous. It's very complicated. And there's an example where you can measure the contact network. It's not, people, it's hard to do, but computers, it's very easy to do. I can tell, the number of links between the server here at ITP and elsewhere. Yes? I can count them. And these networks are known, and they have a very strange property. The property is that the number of bonds varies widely. It's not the contact, not the infectivities that vary. It will come to infectivities in a minute. But the number of bonds. There are a huge number of bonds between some server at AT&T and lots of other servers, but those servers have few bonds. Yes? So you have what's called a scale-free network, where you have a power law distribution of the number of bonds. That's quite unlike a square lattice, where the number of bonds is 4. Okay. And I hope I've convinced you that SIR epidemics are equivalent to percolation. So we can talk about percolation. Let's talk about percolation on those networks. And many of these things have a percolation threshold of 0. That means you always percolate. You cannot avoid percolating. Mm-hmm. Then that is why computer viruses can't be stamped out. That's the claim. Okay? And Vespignani, Alessandro Vespignani, is a person who's done some remarkable work on this subject. Gave a talk on, and he said, talked about the I love you virus, which is 2 years old and very easy to suppress. It's still out there. And the reason for that is that you can't, because PC is 0, and I'll say why in a minute. And then I'll come back to people and say that I don't quite believe what people are saying about people, but we'll come to that in a minute. Okay, so I probably do about computers. So this Barabasi and Albert have gotten a lot of mileage out of an idea which actually goes back to some economics in the 1960s of having of a growth model for a network. That is to say, I am setting up a server. Who do I decide to connect to first? It's some server which already got a lot of bonds. And so if the probability of connection of a new server is proportional to the number of bonds already on that other server, that's a growth model. And you can solve that growth model and you find that the probability of having a number of bonds k, it goes like 1 over k cubed. There are a few very heavily used servers and then there are a lot of ones that don't use. Now I want you to just quote, remark something that's important, is that in nature, many networks have this power, not three. Three is very rare, actually. It's between two and three. And just a simple fact from elementary mathematics, the variance of the number of bonds diverges, but the mean exists. Okay? All right. So, this is, people said this ad nauseum, removing random bonds doesn't bring down the internet, removing MIT does bring down the internet. Okay, targeted attack is important. And here, I'm sure you've all seen pictures like this. This is a picture of part of the internet. And you see there are some of these servers out here, this is a very small part. Some of these servers out here are just sort of at the ends, but then you have these clusters and some huge cluster, and there's AT&T and Sprint. And
so when something says MCI, it's all the things connected to MCI.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. I got this off Barabashi's website, and you know, you can look there. There's a lot of information.
So what is this in the map of the United States?
Yeah. 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 It's a web in the United States. Yeah.
In the United States.
It's a small part of the web in the United States.
Small.
Yeah.
Oh, it's only a small.
It's only a small part. Oh, yes, indeed, and it's done by sampling. You sent out a bunch of messages,
no,
and
no, but what does it cover?
This
it covers
here. What are the coordinates?
Here? I think this is space.
Yeah. It covers the United States.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As well as you can do. No, that can't be right. I don't. To be absolutely honest, I don't know, and it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It doesn't matter because the connectivity is the only thing that counts. You just put a node somewhere where you can graph it when you're making a picture. I've tried it. And believe me, when you're trying to put things down, it's hard. So you just do the best you can. Okay. Now, that's a very special thing. Let me just quickly say, and this is a little technical, but I think it's interesting, why it is you expect PC equals zero. Because it's actually a very strong conclusion. Now, you might say, why could PC possibly be zero? Here, I'll compute PC for you. First thing I want to say is on these networks, there are very few loops. I can forget loops. Okay? Now, I have P of K here. Yes? So I have an average K bonds coming out of here. Okay? If I dilute them by P, I have an average PK coming out of here. They go to some other place. You know, they go, various of them go to other places. And these each have K, and these each have K. And so the growth of the growth of the cluster goes like pk to the n, where n is the number of generations you go out. And so if you make pk less than 1, the cluster is finite. That's the end of the story. So the percolation threshold must be finite. It's 1 over k. Well, that's wrong. Okay? Why is it wrong? It's because if the clusters, that's right. I mean, everybody who's seen this will recognize that as the right calculation for our Cayley tree. But it's wrong for these graphs. And the reason is that if I take a random bond coming out of a typical site, it's not going to go to a typical site. It's going to go to the site which has more bonds. It's weighted by this guy. And so the multiplication factor I talked about for one of these random graphs, the multiplication factor is, in fact, let me stop a minute. The average of this is the variance of the parent distribution. Right? So the multiplication factor is the variance over the average, the variance squared over the average, variance over the average squared. Right? If the variance diverges, no matter how small you make P, the cluster is infinite. So that's the argument. And the question is, that must be right. And some people assumed it's right. And here is a picture of something everyone is interested in. This is a 2001 Nature article by Gene Stanley and collaborators, in which they analyzed some data from Sweden, in which the people talked about their sexual contacts per number of partners per year and lifetime. This is a histogram. Okay? And there are various remarkable things about this data. I hope you can see the I hope you can see the scale. Another remarkable thing is that that in Sweden, as elsewhere, almost everybody, you know, 95% of the people are heterosexual, and yet the area under the curve of males and females is not the same. There are various explanations for that. And
even a conservation law.
Even in Sweden, there's a conservation law.
There's a conservation law.
They're going to have sexual contact with people in other countries.
I think that's actually a small effect.
But there's still conservation.
All right, Pierre. There are many surveys of this type. I mean, this is a nice picture, but there are many surveys of this type, and this always happens. And there are those who say, well, that's because women lie. Mm-hmm. Are men lying?
Men lie.
Yes.
No, the other thing is the crossover, right?
Yeah. Okay. All right. I mean, we'll talk about that maybe later. The problem probably is that there are sampling errors. If you have a distribution with a very fat tail, there are sampling errors, and the sampling errors can be very large, and you can compute when that is. So there are outliers, and what I'm saying is that there are very likely outliers in this distribution. Sex workers, yes?
Can you say explicitly what the vertical axis is?
No.
It's a cumulative distribution.
It's a probability. Yeah. Pick any Swede, it's a probability of 10 to the minus.
This is... No, this is the cumulative distribution. This is what fraction of the whole area is less than here, is that. Okay? All right. Okay, never mind. Let's assume this is a power law. So the authors of this paper said, well, obviously this is a Barabasi-Albert network. PC is equal to zero, so there's no herd immunity. You can't possibly stop sexually transmitted diseases unless you find the Wilt Chamberlain, yes? The people who are actually responsible for 1,000 sexual contacts. That actually, epidemiologists call that the core group hypothesis. This is a very extreme form of the core group. It says you cannot, even if you had a vaccine for AIDS, it wouldn't do any good. That's what this is saying. And let me make a mathematical point, and conceivably a point about contact networks. Knowing PFK does not characterize the network. Okay? And so here's my point. That there's something left out. For example, the first thing we thought of, was what's left out, is physical proximity. In the, that's what I was saying before, that it doesn't matter how you plot these things because there's no geography in those networks. You can just as easily connect, or almost as easily, connect a computer here and from here to New York as from here to Los Angeles. But for humans, that's different. And various people have told me that it is, in fact, different for them. And my claim is the idea that social contacts are independent of geography is odd.
But suppose you plot the data instead of for all of Sweden, just do it for Stockholm. Presumably the data will be similar, right?
I haven't a clue. Well, why is that important?
Because Stockholm is most of Sweden. Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. And
so you have the same data for Stockholm. Then geography.
Oh, I see. You're saying that everybody in Stockholm
presumably has a good public
transportation. I actually think social networks are much more local than that.
Even more local than the city.
Not just geographic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Social.
So you mean social class and so on.
Yeah, for example. So what I'm going to do is show that you can have a network which has a metric, has a distance, a notion of closeness, has a non-zero threshold, but nevertheless has a power law. I'm going to construct such a network. And Igor Sokolov and I just did this on a blackboard. And we had then tested it. It's as easy as this. I mean, we say, here's a fellow who's seeking contacts. And we draw a circle around him on a lattice. Its area is chosen from a power law distribution. And we connect him to everybody within that network. And then we throw down another circle, and we, like this one, and pick it out. So you can think of this guy as having contacts with this guy, and this guy is having contacts with this guy, who also happens to have contacts with that guy. And these are the shared contacts which are going to lead to percolation. Okay, so the question is, does that network percolate? And this is a well-defined mathematical question, which we can answer in one dimension. I don't know, people living along a highway or something. We can we could answer without any problems. In one dimension, remember, PC equals zero means percolation is inevitable. Okay? In one dimension, percolation is impossible, rigorously, for this model. Okay? But that's, in some sense, not too interesting, because one dimension is always strange in percolation theories. So we went into two dimensions and tried to prove some things, and we found some theorems which are very, very strange. The expected number of points in the biggest cluster for this range of alphas is infinite, but with probability unity, the clusters are finite.
What is alpha?
Alpha is the power.
Of the size of
P goes like 1 over k to the alpha. Yeah, that's right, the area of the circle. Okay. Now, how can this happen? Well, it can happen if a distribution is normalizable but lacks a mean. Okay? And we know that there are such distributions. The distribution for the probability distribution for the size of the cluster. And so this is sometimes called intermittency. So we didn't know what to make of that. In particular, since it has nothing to do with spanning. So we decided to look at this numerically. And the numerical evidence is very strong that this model has a finite percolation threshold right down to alpha equal 2, not 3. And for example, this is 2.05. Now, this is a kind of plot that many of you are familiar with. It's a primitive finite size scaling plot against 1 over L. The size of the lattice 1 over L, these huge lattices, 4 million. Okay? And you can do percolation because there are sufficient ways to do it. And what we plot is the apparent percolation threshold, getting rid of those finite size effects that I talked about. But in this manner. And certainly 2.3, 2.5, I don't think that you would quarrel with the idea that that's going to go asymptotically to a finite value, an infinite cluster. Below 2, you get something which looks like a power law going down. Okay? So my claim is that above alpha equal 2, not 3, 2, in the relevant physical range, it looks very much like geography is significant. So here's my results. You know, 0.09 for this one, 0.15, and so on. We've tried that, but these things, you know, you have all these power laws running around. Finite size effects are a nightmare. So that we're lucky if we can measure PC, roughly speaking. The answer is I don't know what the critical exponents are. We have some indirect evidence of the critical exponents. The critical exponent gamma does change when alpha is less than 3. The reason for that is we did small world effects on the small world effects with this thing. I won't go into that. And that depended on that gamma, and it sort of didn't work below 3. But never mind. The right answer is I don't know. Okay, so small world effects, however, only shift PC. They don't change the effect, that is not in the least clear. That if you have a metric, and if you have that you should be very careful about these claims that small world networks tell you something about vaccination strategies. And here is my conclusions. We figured out spatial patterns using percolation theory. It's kind of fun. We've noted that variability in contact rates are susceptibilities, broadens the region where there's patchy infection. So patchy infection is not going to be an accident, rare accident. And scale-free networks in the sense that the bond distribution is a power law, do not necessarily mean infections are unstoppable. Thank you. Yeah, sure I do. It's because for alpha, below alpha equal 2, there's no mean. So below alpha equal 2, you can percolate in one step. Right? The mean size diverges. So if you make a bigger and bigger lattice, you get more and more tries to get a huge cluster which will percolate all in one step. So PC is obviously 0. Above 3, it's just, above 3, everyone agrees that it's just ordinary. It's a PC is finite, and none of this plays a role. Yeah?
It is easy to understand why the internet distribution must be a scale-free network. Is there a way to understand why this section interaction should have this k equal to 3 or whatever?
So why should sexual contact networks be scale-free? Frankly, there was some speculation in that paper, where the kind of speculation I would rather not indulge in. There's this sort of 25-cent sociology you can do that people who are very attractive attract more people or something like that. But
how about other social?
I don't know very much about them. There are certainly many power laws that show up in human affairs, like power law distributions of income, the Pareto distribution, and yeah, citations and so forth. I don't know if there's any common, if there's any reason for any common mechanism.
Question. When I've got my computer connected to the internet, it's always connected in the same number of nodes, but with sexual contact patterns, it's usually intermittent. That was partners per lifetime, so that's how many I've accumulated, not how many I'm contacting at this minute. So the idea of concurrency then comes in, whether I have serial monogamy and to what extent things overlap. And are you able to incorporate that, and how might that, for example, affect the thresholds?
Well, since they're interested in sexually transmitted diseases, then insofar as, and by the way, part of that data is for 1 year, then it wouldn't matter if it was serial or concurrent.
Hmm. No, but not if it's lifetime.
Not if it's lifetime. No, I make no claims about that. I absolutely agree. And I don't think anyone has really attempted to take into account, you know, sort of time dependence of that type. That would be much harder data to collect. I mean, you know, you're already intruding in people's lives in a big way when you do this.
I mean, there is data on concurrency, and that's an issue in HIV, whether concurrency is important to the spread. In fact, some models suggest that it would spread significantly if you have concurrency as opposed to serial monogamy.
You mean because of the very infectious period of HIV is a month or something?
That's part of the reason, yeah. Uh-huh.
Because, okay. I mean, but you know, also concurrency is in the eye of the beholder. You'd have to decide what you mean. We'll talk about it later, Tony.